This is part three of a three-part podcast series entitled The Nation's Next Submarine and Anti-Submarine Warfare. Today, Cyprus is honored to get a chance to discuss perspectives of two leaders in this field, with a special emphasis on the undersea warfare fight. Admiral retired Jamie Fogo and Vice Admiral retired Bruce Lindsay support Cyprus and Cyprus clients as part of our valued subject matter experts team.
I was just reflecting, listening to your story and taking a look at the notes I had independently, just how much this is a business of people. You know, my interaction with General Hamilton, he was one of the deputies at J-8 when I was a lieutenant over on J-8 as a J-ROC intern. And he was fantastic. And he had a great picture of him helping to make a stop in the 1967 Army-Navy game. And it was one of my great stories. And he had such a great interview with my mom when I got my indetour as a lieutenant from the joint staff. And it's just so fun seeing different people, how they interact over time, even from a joint perspective. Bird, you've served as a carrier strike group commander and also at the Fleet Forces command level. Do you see implementations of the goals of Project Overmatch possibly affecting how the nation uses and integrates submarines as part of our strike groups moving forward?
John, that's a good question. And the answer is easy to me. Yes, a big yes. When you examine distributed maritime operations and expeditionary advanced based operations through a sea control and power projection lens, you're going to quickly come to the conclusion that the submarine force must be fully integrated into not only the strike groups, but the entire fleet. If it is to be a value-added sensor or a value-added shooter or just somebody who's going to make a decision in this maritime ecosystem that a lot are talking about, the kill web, call it the maritime kill web. So I'm glad you used the word integrated also, because if you are not integrated into the maritime strike ecosystem, which is an important part of the sea, air, land battle of the Indo-Pacific area, then you cannot contribute in any meaningful way, at least not at the speed of relevance. And please note what I said, sea, air, land battle. And I use that to highlight the primacy of the sea services supported by the air and the land services in any future campaign in the Indo-Pacific region. It's going to take the joint force, no doubt about it, but it's got to be led by the naval force. And if you think of the Marine Corps, they talk about their stand-in units. Those are their Marines that are already there in the island chain. Well, you know what our stand-in forces are? Under the sea. Those are the ones that the enemy just doesn't know where they are, but they're there. Yes, we have Ronald Reagan, but we know when it's in port, out of port. So those stand-in forces, and that is the submarine force. So yes, the Navy must integrate all its sensors and shooters and decision makers first, and then integrate the fleet into the joint maritime kill web. And it starts with the submarine force. Over to you.
As a follow-up to that, Bertie, how much do you think our future submarine attack submarine hull count will or should come from the requirement to conduct integrated and joint operations with the carrier strike groups and our aviation partners? Or do you think that by necessity, we're doing more missions, I'm talking about submarine force now, alone and unafraid in the contested littorals where our strike groups cannot presently venture?
Well, I'm going to want to hear what Jamie thinks about this from a strictly doctrinal perspective, but I believe all, that includes manned and unmanned SSNs and underwater vehicles. Now, that being said, yes, the submarine force, both manned and unmanned, can and will do missions alone and unafraid. However, you know, when the mission requires those effects, whether they be kinetic or non-kinetic or the operational and preparational environment, you got to be quickly passing that information from another sensor to a shooter to the decision maker. Again, this comes back to being integrated. If you're not integratable, then you're not relevant. Jamie, do you have any thoughts about that?
John and Bertie. Bertie's kind of opened my eyes to this and brought my attention to many of Secretary of Defense Austin's speeches, you know, starting with, I believe it was May 3rd last year when Admiral Phil Davidson retired. He made his famous comment about the, you know, the Davidson Gate has become known as where China will attack Taiwan by 2027. But throughout all this, you know, the Secretary talks about integrated deterrence as using the right mix of technology, operational concepts, and capabilities, all brought together by a network. And here we go back 20 years again to Art Zabrowski, right? This network's so powerful and this set of capabilities is so powerful that it will set our adversaries back on their heels. And I think the SSN plays a critical role here, particularly with the variety of payloads that we need to put on the next generation submarine and the capability that we need to give it to conduct indications and warning, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, you know, covert operations, covert strikes, and stay out there with dwell for a long period of time. So instead of relying on pure numbers or capacity to achieve overmatch against our adversaries, integrated deterrence is really the strategy that brings this hybrid mix of technology, unmanned systems enabled by artificial intelligence to the table, and include in that integration the allies too, a robust network of allies with, that can exponentially increase the size and speed of our striking power. Most recently, you know, the Quad, AUKUS. AUKUS is more than just about putting a nuclear submarine in the inventory of our Australian friends and allies. It's about the message that it sends to China. It's about the fact that, you know, who says AUKUS just stays AUKUS? You know, why can't we? So who says the Quad just stays at four? We could increase that to a much higher number. Admiral Harris made that comment, Ambassador Harris, when he was out at West in San Diego. And, you know, you guys know I'm a Francophone and a Francophile. Don't forget the French. They got 8,500 people out in the French Polynesia. And that's not an area that Indo-PACOM should have to worry about because they have a very capable force. In fact, they took over after Harry S. Truman did Neptune 22 and they're standing guard with their carrier in the Eastern Mediterranean as part of that NATO task force while the fight in Ukraine is going on. We're going to have to fight at longer ranges, and this is going to require some new tactical and strategic thinking and how to align our weapon systems with our platforms in order to strike over the horizon. USS John Finn did a strike many months ago, a few months, 6 months, 9 months ago with an SM-6 weapon over the horizon that was guided in by an unmanned aerial vehicle that was out in public literature. So networking and connectivity must be through hardened data links, artificial intelligence-enabled computing, high-speed data processing, and you got to include the allies in the process. I think all that can be done on a number of platforms, including the submarine. John, back to you.
Thank you very much. Thank both of you for that very complete answer. Vice Admiral Houston, Commander Submarine Forces, describes the submarine and the eventual SSNX, whatever it turns out to be, as an apex predator. Many Navy and submarine specific leaders speak to the requirement for speed, torpedo room payload, vertical launch capacity for submarine strike for our next attack submarine in that order of precedence. Where do you think someone who has served has commanded these vessels overseas, where do you think industry needs to help our submarine design and construction base as we get ready to stand up this new program office at NAVC in pursuit of these goals?
Well, thanks, John, and thanks for mentioning Vice Admiral Houston. I'm so proud of him. I had the opportunity to pin on his third star down in Norfolk when he took over at Submarine Forces from Admiral Darrell Cottle, who then fleeted up to be Fleet Forces Command. Both Darrell and Admiral Houston were subgroup eights under me in Naples. I knew Admiral Houston when he was a lieutenant. I was a CO in Oklahoma City. He was the engineer on Hampton. That's where I did my kiddie cruise before I went out to take over the Oklahoma City. He was brilliant then, and he's even more brilliant now. And, you know, with those two guys down there leading Fleet Forces Command and our submarine force, we're in really good shape. And so Bill does talk about the apex predator. It's not just the SSNX. He believes that the Virginia is an apex predator, and I agree with him, because we still have the competitive advantage and edge over Severodvinsk, which we'll talk about in a minute. But, you know, I won't sit here and pop off as the retired armchair strategist and tell you this is what I want for the next attack submarine program. I'm going to tell you what I think the consensus is. And again, I fall back on our friend, been mentioned several times today here, Ronald Rourke up at the Congressional Research Service, who had a great memo on the next generation attack submarine SSNX program that came out on 9 December 21. It's public literature. You can download it on the internet. And one of the things he said was, unlike the Virginia class, which was designed for multi-mission dominance in the littoral, SSNX will be designed for greater transit speed under increased stealth conditions in all ocean environments. So remember, I'm wrestling with the idea of, do we need to tweak the propulsion system on Virginia anymore? Is that something you want to migrate to electric drive? Certainly electric drive gives you more capacity from the reactor plant to use the energy to use for weapon systems. So that's something we've got to figure out. But every one of these things is tied to a cost. It's going to drive your costs up. And we don't have the SCN dollars to be able to do that. We don't have that luxury. Unless, of course, we do break that one-third, one-third, one-third paradigm. And I'll probably say that a couple more times on the program here. Carry a larger inventory of weapons and diverse payloads. Get payload. 2001, Admiral Bowman, right? We've talked a lot about that today, so it's still relevant. Design the submarine to retain multi-mission capability and sustain combat presence in denied waters. I think that's something that's a carryover from not just the Virginia class, but the Los Angeles class, the Sturgeon class. I mean, I started this business in 1983 on my first boat, USS Sea Devil, 664, Sturgeon class submarine, and that was our mission then. It'll have a renewed priority in anti-submarine warfare against sophisticated threats in greater numbers. Amen. Russia, China. We'll talk about Severodvinsk. We'll talk about Belograd. And we'll talk about all the submarines that the Chinese are producing. The actual design of SSNX will be impacted by cost. We talked about that. And then there's a statement in there about, should we look at low enriched uranium? I think other navies do. We've always had highly enriched uranium. But, you know, would that marry up with electric drive? I don't know. That's a question mark out there. And then the last thing is, do we want to build this submarine, the new one, the same way we built the Virginia, which got the cost down? We're producing them on time, on target, on budget. Do we want to do the same teaming arrangement between two shipyards, or do we want to have independent shipyards producing these fine new boats? And it's a question mark. You know, so it's something I think that the Navy has to look at, and it'll come down to what's the best use of our precious dollars. You know, how more cost effective is it to go to a 1-yard solution versus a 2-yard teaming solution? John, back to you.
Thank you for that perspective. I echo your congratulations to Admiral Houston. Bill was my deputy during my command tour and supported me when I was on the Maryland, and I was proud to know him then and in awe of his career since then. So certainly great to see our friends. You mentioned Admiral Hilarities earlier. It's great to see, you know, his wonderful career. He was one of the people who reached out and talked to me about acquisition way back in the day. A follow-on to this, and it has to do with the Russians. Certainly as a midshipman, I remember it seemed like any letter in the phonetic alphabet from Alpha all the way up to Zulu, you could pick one and there would be a Russian submarine tied to it. No exaggeration. How would you compare the Russian design methodology and their concentration, sort of rapid proliferation of designs with small numbers of units in each to our nation's, America's philosophy of spiraling improvements to Los Angeles and Virginia class culls with large numbers of hull counts? Could you compare and contrast that for us, please?
Yeah, love to. So this is the Russians have been doing for quite a while, maybe even before us, spiral development. And by that, I mean, you know, Admiral Rickover used to talk about, don't give me any paper reactors. He wanted prototypes. That's why we had prototypes in Connecticut. We had prototypes out in Idaho. We have prototypes down in Charleston. And he wanted to prototype designs. And, you know, we would train on these new designs. One of those ships was USS Narwhal. That was my XO tour. And then he would learn from them. And if they were successful, he would produce them in higher numbers. The Russians are really good at spiral development. They're really good at rapid prototyping. You know, the from the November to the Alpha class, you all remember the Alpha class titanium hull deep diving goes super fast. And they didn't make a lot of them, so they probably didn't see that it was either cost effective or in their analysis, combat effective, but we were certainly impressed. You know, they build, test, build, and they modify designs as you're going along. I think one of the reasons for this, and I wrote about this in one of my previous articles, I think it was the Fourth Battle, was the head of the design bureau, who's sort of retired now, Dr. Igor Spassky. You know, I think he's a hero of the Soviet Union. I think he stopped, you know, every day, day to day, go to work every day, work in the design bureau around the time that the Akula class submarine came up, maybe sooner than that. The real expert on this is Norman Pulmar, who's done a lot of research over there. But, you know, after the Cold War was over and we were in this, you know, relative era of peace, which didn't last long, there was a gathering of submariners around the time of the 100th or the centennial of the U.S. Submarine Force in 2000. And I had served on a board at Naval Submarine League, and I remember hearing Admiral DeMars, who was the chairman, talk about a trip overseas that he really enjoyed. And he got to meet Dr. Igor Spassky. And he asked him, hey, would you write an article for the Naval Submarine League Review on your life as a designer of Russian submarines? And the guy, he did it. You know, Jim Patton had the keys to that. Jim recently passed away, great submariner. And I remember reading that article and being fascinated. It was written like an engineer, you know, would write. It was long and you know, kind of boring. But the fact that the guy did it in our journal was impressive. And look at where we are now. So in this spiral development, they've come up with a couple of pretty impressive new platforms, Severodvinsk. So when it first came out, Dave Johnson, Admiral Johnson, who was PEO subs, told his NAVSEA engineers, and they had, you know, the wherewithal to do this, build me a ship model of Severodvinsk, put it in the lobby of the building, and tell everybody that's the competition. And I love that story, and I love Dave for doing that. That's, you know, that's cool. It's the kind of thing I would want to do to motivate my people. And it is a very effective, stealthy, and lethal platform. You know, we talked about upping the ante for weapons with Virginia payload module. You know, our Virginias would have 66 weapons to Russia's 72. So it's pretty important that we'd be able to outstick them both in quantity and capability. But that's an impressive platform, and they've got the second one out now, and it's probably even better. Then there's the Belograd, the K-329 program. This ship can carry that long-range supposed nuclear-powered torpedo that Putin himself revealed that, you know, is professed to be able to transit the Atlantic towards who else but the east coast of the United States of America. And at the same time, it's got two missions. It carries the mini-sub, which could interdict undersea critical infrastructure. Now, that scares the hell out of me, particularly right now, John, because of what's going on in Europe and Ukraine. And, you know, these economic sanctions, if Putin's crazy enough to up the ante on his nuclear alert posture, then he could not only go after us in cyberspace, but try to impact critical undersea infrastructure. And that's where 99% of our communications for the market and for, you know, military matters go. So I think that's significant. And I think, quite frankly, what the Russians have been able to do in the undersea domain is impressive, which is why I wrote the piece, The Fourth Battle of the Atlantic, as a wake-up call and a warning order that we cannot ignore the importance of presence in the undersea domain in the North Atlantic theater. And that is not just in the waters of the North Atlantic. It's in all what I call the creeks and tributaries that intersect the North Atlantic on the other side, the Baltic Sea, the Mediterranean Sea, the Black Sea, and the high north in the Arctic. And that's probably our next contentious region with both the Russians and the Chinese up in the high north in the Arctic. Back to you.
Thank you. That is a very sobering assessment, and our nation definitely has its, and submarine force and Navy has its task cut out for it. Thank you both very much for what has been a great discussion today and throughout the series. This marks the conclusion of our discussion on undersea warfare and the nation's next submarine, and I look forward to seeing you and everyone else out there at Sea Air Space in a couple of weeks.